Court will proceed to the sixth case, United States versus Miscellaneous Firearms. Mr. Gardner.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor, the primary issue in this case, the initial statutory construction issue, involves Section 924 D1 of Title 18, which says that any action or proceeding for the forfeiture of firearms and ammunition shall be commenced within 120 days of seizure. And the question is really comes down to the word, what does the word any mean? The government argues that it can mean either or. Notably, though, the government doesn't cite any case law that shows that any is interpreted to has been interpreted to mean either or, other than a couple of cases interpreting it in this case. But in so interpreting, I think that the government has actually, in the other cases, the two or three district court cases and the Sixth Circuit opinion, have actually run directly contrary to a more recent Supreme Court decision that interpreted the word any also in Section 924, albeit in Section 924C. This is not Section 924D. That's the Gonzalez case, where the court was construing the term any other term of imprisonment. And in that case, the first thing the court said is that because there's no indication that Congress intended to give the word any other meaning than its common ordinary meaning, that was the meaning the court was going to apply to it. And the court said, therefore, that any means all. And other dictionary meanings would be all or every. And of course, it's well-established rule of statutory construction that when the same word is used in a different part of the same act, and in this case, it's not only the same act, it's the same section of the act, the words are intended to have the same meaning.
Well, now the Sixth Circuit has taken the government's position.
Correct. That's correct.
And a couple other circuits, in unpublished opinions, have cited that, right?
I'm not aware of any unpublished circuit opinions. There are two or three district court opinions which have taken that position, mm-hmm. and all these opinions all stem back to the district court opinion, actually out of the Central District of Illinois, where this case comes, although that's out of a previous case out of the Central District of Illinois. And they've all, in our view, made the same fundamental error in interpreting the word any. Now, of course, in fairness to the initial district court opinion that interpreted any to mean either or, the Gonzalez case at that point had not been decided. The Gonzalez case came several years later. And so I think that the Gonzalez case makes clear what the Supreme Court's view of the word any is in Section 924, which guidance the district court then didn't have. The other thing is that you can look at the construction of the statute.
In your view, if an administrative forfeiture proceeding is started within 120 days, what in addition do they have to do?
Excuse me?
What do they have to do besides that?
Well, let me. What they have to do is they
going at the same time.
They have to move. They have to file the judicial proceeding also within 120 days.
Okay. And one of the two. Does that make any sense?
It does if you understand what the administrative process here. And one of the fundamental errors of all the courts here has been the interpretation of the so-called administrative proceeding. Under the Internal Revenue Code section, section 7325. Which is the procedure that applies here, that's not an administrative proceeding at all. All it is a claim process. It requires the government to send out notice.
But doesn't the law generally disfavor administrative proceedings going, judicial proceedings starting while administrative proceedings are still?
Your Honor, this isn't an independent administrative proceeding. It's a precondition to a judicial proceeding. That's all it is. The statute simply says that the government is to provide notice by publication or personal notice, and then says that the individual is to file a claim. The minute he files the claim, the statute mandates that the matter be sent for judicial proceeding. It is not an independent process. It's merely a means of initiating the judicial proceeding. That's all it is. And because there's no power under that statute for the government to forfeit. The only thing that happens if the claim isn't timely filed, then the statute allows the government to dispose of the property.
I'm trying to see where the harm is to a claimant here, but
well, the purpose
the interpretation of the government puts on
the purpose of the of Congress amending the statute to put in the 120 days was precisely to prevent the government from going on ad infinitum in initiating judicial proceedings. And in the government's reasoning in this case, because that because Section 7325 only deals with matter with property that's worth less than $100,000, what that means is that if once the government starts that administrative process by giving the notice for property that's worth $100,000, they basically can wait forever at that point to initiate the judicial proceeding, which is precisely the evil that Congress was trying to get at when it put in the 120-day requirement. But it's critical to understand.
Well, there's a big difference between saying that the government wait too long. I don't know, there's all kinds of defenses that might be invoked in that situation. But how long did they wait here?
They filed the, I think it was about 2 years before they filed the administrative, the judicial forfeiture proceeding, even though they had they started the administrative process within a month or two.
Yeah, but they really can't do much while the case was pending. The evidence was seized, and we had it up to the case here up on appeal, and a lot of time that has to pass.
They certainly could have filed the administrative, they certainly could have filed the judicial proceeding. They had plenty of time to do that because the claim was timely, was promptly filed, and they had...
Would it make any sense to file a judicial proceeding while the possibility exists that the conviction would be, the underlying conviction would be set aside?
Your Honor, I would say it's not a question of whether it makes sense. This is what Congress mandated. Congress was concerned...
Sometimes Congress is supposed to make sense.
Well, I think they make sense in this case, and the sense is that they want the administrative, the judicial process started promptly.
Have to stay the judicial process pending the outcome of the criminal case, wouldn't they?
They would have to what?
They would have to stay the proceedings pending the outcome of the criminal case.
Absolutely. And that
so what sense is there to filing it immediately because that's what Congress wanted so they can sit and wait for the end of the case?
Well, that...
We're back to
the point of the
question. You said it made sense, and I want to know what sense it makes when you describe it.
It makes sense because that forces the government to make a decision as to whether it's going to move for forfeiture or not. And in many cases, if you look at the historical
You wouldn't have gotten it back anyway during the pending of that period.
That's right, but in many, many cases, as the legislative history shows, the government was seizing property and not doing anything. And that's what Congress was trying to get at, was the fact that the government was seizing property and not initiating forfeiture. But the forfeiture proceeding could certainly be stayed pending a criminal proceeding. But again, the question is not whether it's a good policy or a bad policy. The question is, what is the policy that Congress established? And the other evidence of what Congress intended here is if you look at Section 924D2, which requires a court to award attorney's fees in any action or proceeding for the return of firearms, it's clear that Congress had in mind a judicial proceeding. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense when you talk about an action or proceeding in which the court is to award attorney's fees. And that phrase is the identical phrase that is found in 924D1. Now, the government also argues that the statute here, the word any, is ambiguous. And I would argue that it's not ambiguous, that the Supreme Court in Gonzales had no problem understanding what any meant. But if it is ambiguous, because this is a forfeiture proceeding, which is to be strictly construed against the government as a criminal case, the word any, therefore, has to be construed against the government and in favor of the claimant in this case, which would apply the 120 days would apply to the judicial proceeding as well. And I just want to make one other point about the, if I might, and I will submit on the briefs with regard to the Commerce Clause issue, with regard to the 120-day issue. The government cites 26 U.S.C. 7327 as incorporating the customs forfeitures laws. It does not. Section 7327, by its own terms, imports only the remission and mitigation process, which is the Supreme Court has made clear and is a totally different process from the forfeiture process, so that the 5-year statute of limitations in the customs forfeitures law has absolutely nothing whatever to do with this case.
All right. Thanks, Gardner. Mr. Sanchez?
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Esteban Sanchez. I'm an assistant United States attorney, and I represent the United States.
You want to push the button on there, the whole thing lowers. Reach underneath there.
Right to your right.
Can't see me?
Yeah, well, no, I think. Bingo, yeah. Stop.
We haven't taken
it again. Not too far, you'd be down on your knees.
Your Honor, we ask that you affirm the decision of the district court as to both issues presented by defendant. Let's start out with the issue that Mr. Gardner has addressed. It's this issue of the administrative forfeiture. I think it's important to understand the concept of administrative forfeiture. An administrative forfeiture is commenced after an agency has seized property and intends to forfeit it. To commence administrative forfeiture, the agency must send notice to potential claimants and must publish in a newspaper of general circulation 3 consecutive weeks. Counsel suggests that this procedure is mainly a notice or a claimant searching process, or in another part of his brief he claims, he asserts that this is mostly an abandonment or equals it to an abandonment type proceeding, that if nobody files a claim, then there is no abandonment. But that is not all that the administrative process does. In an administrative forfeiture proceeding, Your Honor, the notice is sent and the claimant is given basically 4 options. The first one is to do nothing, in which case the property is forfeited to the United States and title is vested in the United States. The other option is for the claimant to file a claim. At that time, the claimant had to file a claim asserting that they challenge the forfeiture of the property, that they have an interest in the property, and the matter is then, at the time they require a cost bond, it's no longer required, and then the property is referred to the United States attorney to review the facts and commence a judicial forfeiture proceeding. The third option that a claimant has, and this is, I think, where counsel is wrong, is that the third option is that the claimant can say, look, I believe that the property should be forfeited because, for example, it was possessed in violation of law, in terms of the law. But there should be some mitigating factors that the head of the agency should consider and should mitigate or remit the forfeiture to me for a particular set of facts. And the fourth option, which is not suggested but is frequently done by claimants, is to submit both a petition for remission or mitigation or a claim challenging the forfeiture. So when Ms. Flashley, through his attorney, claims that the administrative forfeiture proceeding is nothing but a claimant searching mechanism, I believe that is an incorrect view of the administrative forfeiture. In fact, the Supreme Court has recognized that the administrative forfeiture encompasses both the petition for remission or mitigation and the filing of a claim in United States versus $8,850, which is cited in the government's brief. So any assertion that the statute really requires the commencement of a judicial forfeiture action within 120 days and ignores the procedures of an administrative forfeiture because it's just nothing but a claim-seeking mechanism, I think is erroneous. Clearly, in this case, as the word any is used in 924 D1, the courts that have interpreted this language, this specific language, has found, first, that the language is ambiguous, and that the language is ambiguous because Congress intended for administrative forfeitures to take its toll, to take its place. That upon seizure of the property, the forfeiture should be commenced within 120 days by an administrative forfeiture, either that or by a judicial forfeiture. nothing in the statute suggests that the that a judicial forfeiture is required. If that was the case, the Congress would have so specified, I would have not adopted the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code as well as the provisions of the customs laws that are incorporated by several references. I submit to the court that the cases that the government has presented, particularly the case cited by the government, the Sixth Circuit case that this court has regarded U.S. versus 93 various firearms, clearly sets forth that the term any action or proceeding means either or. In this case, the forfeiture proceeding was commenced, the administrative forfeiture proceeding was commenced within 120 days, and Judge Mills was correct in finding so, and that ruling should be affirmed. In addition to the Sixth Circuit, Judge Flom, you were correct. Other circuits have, in an unpublished opinion, affirmed the ruling of the lower court. In particular, the case of U.S. versus Mowat, I believe is the party's name, was affirmed. I believe it's a district.
But I don't believe they have any analysis.
You're correct. It's not very deep in its analysis, but it did affirm the lower court decision. The other courts that have interpreted this provision, Your Honor, clearly has also indicated, other than the Eastern District of Virginia Court, clearly has found that the provision in this section is ambiguous and that Congress intended it to mean either or, otherwise it would not give effect to the incorporation of the administrative forfeiture proceedings. With regard to the second argument, the 922G1 argument, what is required to prove the interstate nexus with regard to felony possession of a firearm, Your Honor, I submit to you that our brief clearly set forth the applicable law in this case, both from the Supreme Court and from this district, and I ask the court to affirm that decision as well. And so if there's any other questions, this concludes the government's presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Sanchez. Mr. Gardner? Gardner, were you the successful attorney in your home district?
I was not. My partner had that case. Your Honor, I wanted to just, in my very brief time, if you can give me a minute or two.
You may have that.
Thank you. With respect to the United States versus $8,850 case from the Supreme Court, that court itself makes clear that the remission process, and I think even the government has kind of suggested that now, that the petition for remission and mitigation process and the forfeiture process are really two independent things. The court said at page 566, an important justification for delaying the initiation of forfeiture proceedings is to see whether the Secretary's decision on the petition for remission or mitigation will obviate the need for judicial proceedings. I think the court clearly understood, as it has over the years, that we're talking about two independent processes. One is the judicial process, which begins with an administrative claim process, and the other is a remission process. And indeed, the government even notes now that its third option is that you can initiate the forfeiture is initiated, and at the same time, a petition can be filed. The two are not part of the same thing. And if you look at the statute, section 7325, which is the provision of the Internal Revenue Code, which deals with forfeiture, there's no reference in there to remission or mitigation. This simply says that you give the notice, as the government explained, and that if nobody files the claim and the cost bond, the property can be sold. That's all it is. And that really is all that process is a notification process. And once that's done, then you move into the judicial process. And the term action or proceeding, therefore, really only refers to a judicial proceeding. The last point I wanted to make is that one court said that a number of these courts have said that the word any is ambiguous because you have two courts going different ways. The one thing the Supreme Court has made clear, and I cited just one of the cases, the Reno versus Correa case, but there are numerous other ones, is that just because two courts have come to a different opinion on a statute doesn't make the statute ambiguous. And in this case, the statute, the word any, is not ambiguous.
Actually, it just makes the courts ambiguous. So.
Excuse me? It
just makes the courts ambiguous.
I guess it shows the potential weakness in our circuit system, that different courts can go different ways. But
I don't think that's a weakness. I think it's a strength.
Maybe it's a strength. But ultimately, the Supreme Court sits on top and makes the final decision.
They do. They
and
do.
As I said, with regard to the word any, in the Gonzalez case, the Supreme Court had no problem finding that term was not ambiguous and finding that it meant every or all.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Sanchez. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.